Welcome to the Healing Plate Podcast. Whole food, real nutrients every day. Healing for your body, the way it was designed to be.
If you were to walk through a typical grocery store right now, you know, you would honestly think we are living through a national protein famine.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, it is printed in massive, bold letters on absolutely everything. We're talking protein chips, protein cereal, protein coffee creamers. I even saw high-protein edible cookie dough yesterday.
Wow. Yeah, it's everywhere.
Right. But medically speaking, true protein deficiency causes a clinical crisis where your body literally starts cannibalizing its own organs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a condition that is virtually non-existent in everyday America. So why are we aggressively panic buying all this fortified cookie dough?
Well, it's a brilliant, highly pervasive marketing narrative.
Yeah.
I mean, the food industry has managed to create this underlying anxiety that we're always operating at a biological deficit.
Yeah.
They've sold us the idea that the only real path to health is paved with, you know, massive tubs of isolated muscle powder or endless chicken breasts.
Mm-hmm. Which is exactly why we need to cut through that checkout aisle noise today. Welcome to the third episode of the Healing Plate Podcast. Today, we are focusing on the third of the six major classes of nutrients, which is protein.
Right.
And we've gathered a substantial stack of sources for this deep dive, from the newly released 2025 to 2030 dietary guidelines to reports from the national academies and some foundational medical physiology texts.
A lot of material.
It is. And our mission is to look at the actual biological reality of this nutrient. So, setting the marketing aside, I have to ask you, what is the actual physiological gap between the protein we think we need and the protein our bodies are actually using?
To understand that gap, you know, we have to recognize that we've completely flattened a complex biological miracle into a cheap buzzword.
Mm-hmm.
We tend to view protein merely as a bulk commodity, like grams of muscle that you just pack into your body like drywall.
Right, right.
But if we really want to understand the science here, we need to stop looking at it as a bulk material and start understanding it as an alphabet of microscopic building blocks.
I really want to unpack that building block idea because while I was reviewing the physiology notes for today's deep dive, I realized that our bodies don't just absorb a piece of steak or, you know, a handful of almonds directly into our biceps.
No, not at all.
I was trying to visualize it, and it feels a lot like swallowing a pre-built Lego castle.
I actually love that visual. Walk me through how you're picturing it.
Well, if I eat a piece of chicken, my body can't just take a tiny pre-made Lego tower from that chicken muscle and attach it to my own shoulder.
Right.
I mean, the immune system would probably freak out anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So the body has to completely dismantle that ingested Lego castle into individual anonymous Lego bricks first.
Okay.
And only then can it take those raw bricks and build its own custom human structures, things like skin or digestive enzymes or antibodies.
That is a phenomenal way to frame it because it highlights the fundamental mechanics of digestion. A protein in your food is essentially a long, incredibly complicated chain of amino acids that has been folded up into a specific three-dimensional shape.
Okay.
So when you swallow that Lego castle, you aren't actually absorbing the food itself. Digestion is the meticulous process of taking those chains apart.
But how does the stomach actually pull that off? Because I've always had this vague idea that the stomach is just a giant vat of acid that melts everything down.
Sure.
But the sources make it sound like a highly coordinated disassembly line.
It is highly coordinated. Mm-hmm. Our bodies are created to be a complex system, and the stomach is the first major checkpoint.
Okay.
When the food hits your stomach, it meets hydrochloric acid. But here is the surprise. The acid's primary job isn't actually to chop the protein up.
Wait, really?
No, its job is to unfold it. We call this denaturing. The acid forces that tightly folded, three-dimensional shape, to unspool into a long, vulnerable string.
Okay, so the acid just unwinds the yarn, so to speak. Who actually comes in and does the cutting?
Once the chain is unspooled, a highly specialized enzyme in your stomach activates and starts clipping that long chain into smaller segments.
Right.
But the stomach is just the rough draft of digestion. It sends these smaller chunks down into the small intestine, which is where the heavy machinery arrives in the pancreas.
And the notes mention something completely wild about how the pancreas ships those enzymes. It sends them as inactive zymogens.
Yes.
Why would the body send enzymes that are turned off? That sounds like a shipping error.
It sounds counterintuitive until you think about what those enzymes are designed to do. They're designed to aggressively destroy protein structures. So if your pancreas produced them in their fully active form, those enzymes would digest the pancreas itself before they ever reach the intestine. It would be catastrophic.
Oh, wow. That is terrifying. It's literally like shipping a bomb with a detonator packed in a separate box so it doesn't blow up the delivery truck.
Precisely. They only activate once they are safely deposited inside the intestinal tract. And once they are turned on, they aggressively chop those protein chains down into tiny fragments.
Oh, okay.
Finally, right on the lining of your intestinal cells, you have a structure called the brush border. It gets that name because under a microscope, the cellular lining looks like the fuzzy bristles of a paintbrush.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and that fuzzy border is packed with final stage enzymes that finish the demolition job. They break everything down into single free amino acids, or occasionally pairs of two or three.
And then they just cross over into the bloodstream.
Yes, through very specific cellular doorways. They're transporters that act like biological turnstiles.
Gotcha.
Once inside, almost everything is broken down into single amino acids and sent straight to the liver. The liver acts as the central dispatcher, deciding which of those individual Lego bricks get shipped out to the rest of the body for building and which get used right there on site.
You know, reading through the texts, I was struck by how little goes to waste. The human digestive tract absorbs something like 90 to 95% of the protein we eat.
It's remarkably efficient.
It really is, but there was a small caveat in there about plant proteins sometimes being slightly less digestible than animal proteins. Is that a legitimate concern or just a technicality?
It's mostly a technicality that gets exaggerated by food marketing.
Okay.
It is true that plants contain dietary fiber and tough cellular walls, and those can shield a small percentage of their proteins from those digestive enzymes.
Right, that makes sense.
But as the physiology texts point out, that is simply a reason to eat a diverse, varied diet. It is absolutely not a reason to declare that plants don't have protein.
All right, so we've successfully demolished the castle. We have these individual amino acids, these single Lego bricks, just floating around inside our cells waiting for a job.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm picturing this, it sounds like absolute chaos. How on earth does the body know what to build with them?
Well, that takes us from the raw bricks to the master blueprint. Every cell in your body contains an owner's manual, which is your DNA.
Okay.
Your DNA is made up of a sequence of chemical bases, often represented by the letters A, T, C, and G. A gene is simply a specific sequence of those letters that provides the exact, rigid instruction for building one single protein chain.
I really want to understand the actual translation part of this, because getting the information from a strand of DNA inside the nucleus out to the rest of the cell seems like a logistical nightmare.
It is complex, yeah.
So how does the blueprint actually communicate with the raw materials?
It happens through an elegant two-step process called transcription and translation. Imagine your DNA is a rare reference book in a library. It cannot leave the nucleus.
Okay, so it's locked in there.
Right. So in step one, which is transcription, the cell basically photocopies the specific page it needs. And that photocopy is made of a molecule called messenger RNA.
Okay, so the messenger RNA is the photocopy that's actually allowed to leave the library.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
It leaves the nucleus and travels to a microscopic manufacturing plant in the cell called a ribosome. This is where step two, translation, happens.
Okay.
Specialized delivery trucks, called transfer RNAs, start bringing the matching amino acids out of your cellular pool. They read the photocopy three letters at a time, and they snap the raw amino acids together in the exact order that the blueprint demands.
But let me push back on this idea of the DNA being the ultimate dictator of this process, because if my blueprint is perfectly written and unchangeable, does the food I eat actually matter?
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, if the script is already locked in, am I not just a biological robot running a program?
Well, if we step back and look at the bigger picture, your DNA is a capability manual, not a forced destiny.
Okay.
The blueprint dictates how to build the house, but the amino acids from your lunch are the physical lumber and nails. You can have the most flawless architectural plans in the world, but if the delivery trucks don't show up with the bricks, the house is not getting built.
That makes total sense.
Furthermore, your lifestyle, you know, your environment, your stress, your physical activity, that all acts as the project manager. It dictates which blueprints the body actually pulls off the shelf to read on any given day.
And when the body does read those blueprints, the sources make it very clear that the exact order of those bricks is critical. The texts use sickle cell disease as an example, and it completely reframed how I think about nutrition.
It's a powerful example.
It really proves that eating protein isn't just about hitting some arbitrary number of grams on a fitness app. It's us about sequence.
Right. Sickle cell disease is the definitive medical teaching case for this exact reason. It shows us that one tiny spelling error can cascade into a systemic crisis.
Right.
Hemoglobin is the protein in your red blood cells responsible for carrying oxygen. In sickle cell disease, there is a mutation in the DNA blueprint for the hemoglobin chain. Just one single letter in the genetic code is misspelled.
Out of a massive complex chain, just one letter is wrong.
Just one. And because of that one misspelled letter in the DNA, the ribosome inserts the wrong amino acid at position number 6 of the protein chain.
Wow.
It swaps out an amino acid called glutamic acid for a different one called valine.
And why does swapping one microscopic piece cause such a devastating physical disease?
Because amino acids have very distinct chemical personalities. Glutamic acid is hydrophilic, meaning it loves water. It sits happily in the watery environment of the blood.
Okay.
Valine, on the other hand, is hydrophobic. It strongly repels water. So when oxygen levels in the blood naturally dip, that one misplaced valine brick panics. It tries to hide from the water, and in doing so, it physically latches on to neighboring hemoglobin molecules.
So they essentially stick together to avoid the water.
Yes, they clump together and stack up into these long, rigid microscopic fibers inside the cell. Those fibers physically warp the entire red blood cell, bending it from a flexible disc into a rigid, sharp sickle shape.
And because they're rigid, they get jammed inside the tiny capillaries and blood vessels.
Exactly. That structural traffic jam causes excruciating pain crises, profound organ damage, and a drastically shortened lifespan for the cells.
All from one letter.
All of this destruction stems from one single altered letter in the DNA manual, which resulted in one wrong physical brick in the chain. It's a profound reminder that we are dealing with a precise biological alphabet, not just a tub of generic fitness powder.
Since our DNA is incredibly strict about the exact spelling of these proteins, that leads to a pretty massive logistical problem. Where do we reliably get the letters?
Right.
The literature says there are 20 standard amino acids that build human proteins, and they are divided into essential and non-essential categories.
That's right. Out of those 20 letters, 9 of them are classified as essential or indispensable.
Okay.
What that means biologically is that the human body completely lacks the internal machinery to manufacture them from scratch. We have no way to create them. Therefore, they absolutely must be absorbed from the food we consume.
Which makes total sense. But then we have the 11 that are labeled non-essential. And I have to say, looking at the sheer physiological necessity of these compounds, calling them non-essential feels like a terrible naming convention.
Oh, it really is.
I mean, if my immune system requires them to build antibodies, my body literally needs them to survive.
You've hit on a notoriously sloppy piece of scientific terminology. They are absolutely vital to human life. The scientific distinction is just that they are dispensable in the diet.
Oh.
Meaning if you don't happen to eat them on a Tuesday, you aren't going to collapse. Your liver is incredibly resourceful. It can usually manufacture those 11 letters by ripping apart other surplus amino acids and reconfiguring the metabolic leftovers.
But the sources noted that the liver's manufacturing plant actually has its limits.
It does. Several of these supposedly non-essential amino acids become conditionally essential during times of extreme metabolic stress.
Like what kind of stress?
If someone suffers severe physical trauma, major burns, or a systemic infection, the immune system's demand for specific amino acids skyrockets.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and your internal factory simply cannot keep up with the order volume. In those moments, those nutrients must be provided through clinical nutrition or food.
So the overarching biological truth is that we need a steady supply of this entire 20-letter alphabet to function.
Yes.
But because those 9 essential letters cannot be made by the body, it has fueled what might be the single most persistent nutritional myth in modern history. The absolute conviction that you can only get those essential letters from animal meat.
The persistence of the protein equals meat myth is staggering, especially because it is biologically false. Plant foods are densely packed with protein.
Yeah.
The data is clear. A single cup of cooked lentils delivers roughly 17 grams of protein. A cup of cooked edamame provides a very similar amount. Even a standard 2 tablespoon serving of peanut butter gives you about 7 or 8 grams.
Which makes the related myth, you know, that vegetarians and vegans are walking around in a constant state of protein deficiency equally confusing.
It's completely unfounded. The Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, which is the preeminent organization of nutrition professionals, has repeatedly affirmed in their position papers that appropriately planned plant-based dietary patterns are highly adequate.
Right.
They consistently support long-term cardiometabolic health, and they easily meet protein requirements. With one caveat, of course, the individual must be consuming a wide enough variety of foods and taking in enough total daily calories.
I want to dig into that history a bit, because even well-meaning health professionals used to make this incredibly stressful. I'm thinking back to the 1970s and the intense panic over complementary protein.
Oh, yes.
And there was this prevailing rule that you had to perfectly pair rice and beans on the exact same plate at the exact same meal, or you were basically malnourished.
Yeah, the complementary protein theory.
Yeah.
It heavily permeated the culture, largely popularized by influential books of that era, like Diet for a Small Planet. The logic was rooted in a partial truth. Some plant proteins are a bit lower in specific essential amino acids. Legumes, for example, tend to be lower in the amino acid methionine. Grains, like rice or wheat, tend to be lower in lysine.
Okay, so they thought you had to match them up perfectly.
Exactly. So the early assumption was that you had to eat them in perfect tandem at every meal so they could complete each other in your stomach.
I feel a profound sense of relief on behalf of our listeners that this isn't true anymore. I mean, the idea of agonizing over my lunch timing because I had toast at 9 a.m. and lentils at 2 p.m. sounds absolutely exhausting.
It is exhausting. And more importantly, it deeply underestimates the sophistication of the human liver. Mm. The author of that theory actually walked it back in later editions of her book. But the public consciousness held on to the panic. Your liver acts as a massive metabolic warehouse. It maintains a free-floating pool of amino acids.
Oh, that's incredibly efficient.
Yeah, as long as you are eating an assortment of whole foods over the course of the day, your liver simply pulls the missing letters from the warehouse as needed. It handles the spelling bee for you.
But if the body is so good at sorting this out, why do we still see these aggressive scoring systems online? You see terms thrown around like PDCAs or DIES.
Right.
And they are always used as definitive proof that animal protein is high quality and plant protein is low quality. What do those acronyms even mean?
Well, PDCAs and DIESs are laboratory scoring metrics. They stand for Protein Digestibility Corrected Amino Acid Score and Digestible Indispensable Amino Acid Score.
That is a mouthful.
It is. Essentially, scientists take a single isolated food, measure how closely its amino acid profile matches a perfect human reference standard, and test how easily it digests in a vacuum.
Okay.
Under those highly specific isolated laboratory conditions, animal products like milk, eggs, and meat score very close to 100%. Isolated plant proteins might score lower because of the fiber we discussed, or because they are slightly lower in one specific amino acid.
But if they score lower in the lab, doesn't that make them scientifically lower quality?
Only if you eat a single food in a sterile vacuum.
Oh.
Applying a narrow laboratory digestibility score as a broad moral ranking for human food is fundamentally flawed science.
Because it ignores the context.
Because it ignores the food matrix. The food matrix is the entire package of nutrients that comes along with the protein.
Right, because you never eat a nutrient in isolation unless you're swallowing a supplement pill.
Precisely. If you sit down and eat a plate of beans, grains, and seeds, you are acquiring all the essential amino acids you need for the day. But that food matrix is also delivering a massive payload of dietary fiber, folate, magnesium, and complex protective plant compounds.
Wow, yeah.
And animal muscle simply does not contain fiber or those specific phytonutrients.
And it seems like ignoring the food matrix leads to some pretty absurd conclusions about what constitutes quality.
It absolutely does.
Yeah.
A heavy, consistent diet of processed fatty meats will aggressively raise LDL cholesterol levels and increase cardiometabolic risk.
Right.
A bowl of lentils does the exact opposite. If our ultimate definition of dietary quality is what helps a human body thrive and avoid chronic disease, then varied whole plant foods are unequivocally high quality.
Yeah, that makes total sense.
Using a lab score to imply that a highly processed hot dog is somehow superior to a lentil, well, it trains the public to ignore the actual lived health impacts of their diet.
Okay, so if both plant and animal sources provide the necessary alphabet, that leads us to the practical reality of our daily lives. How much of this alphabet do we actually need to consume, and is the average person genuinely falling short?
Let's look at the established benchmarks. The recommended dietary allowance, or RDA, established by the National Academies for a Healthy Adult, is 0.8 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight per day.
What does that actually look like on a dinner plate? Give me a sense of the scale for an average adult.
Well, for an adult weighing roughly 150 pounds, that translates to about 50 to 55 grams of protein a day. To put that in food terms, that is easily covered by a bowl of oatmeal in the morning, a sandwich for lunch, and a modest serving of pasta with beans, or a small piece of fish for dinner.
That really does not sound like an insurmountable mountain of food.
Yeah, it's not.
But the notes emphasize that the RDA is specifically the baseline required to prevent clinical deficiency. And you mentioned earlier that true deficiency is severe.
It is catastrophic.
Yeah.
When the body doesn't get the baseline amino acids it needs to sustain basic life functions, it panics and starts tearing down its own muscle tissue to harvest the bricks.
Wow.
You see profound muscle wasting, a collapse of the immune system, and severe fluid retention known as edema.
I want to clarify that edema mechanism because the text mentioned it was due to a loss of albumin. What exactly is albumin doing?
Albumin is an incredibly important protein manufactured by your liver that circulates in your blood. You can think of it like a biological sponge.
Okay.
It creates osmotic pressure, which is what keeps the watery fluid of your blood safely inside your blood vessels.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so if you are starving and your body stops making albumin, that sponge disappears. The fluid leaks out of your blood vessels and pools into the surrounding tissues, causing severe, dangerous swelling.
Which is a tragic clinical reality in areas facing famine or severe medical neglect, but it is deeply detached from the realities of a modern American grocery store.
Very much so.
However, looking at the newly updated 2025 to 2030 dietary guidelines, I noticed they're pushing the target higher than the baseline RDA. They are recommending a range of 1.2 to 1.6 grams per kilogram per day.
Right, that is a significant shift, representing roughly a 50 to 100% increase over the baseline RDA.
So why the big jump?
The rationale behind this higher target is to move beyond merely preventing deficiency and to actively optimize muscle preservation as the population ages while supporting broader metabolic health.
Okay, that makes sense.
But here is the critical piece of data that the marketing industry deliberately ignores. National dietary surveys confirm that U.S. adults are already averaging roughly 80 grams of protein a day from their standard diets.
Wait, they are already hitting 80 grams without even trying.
Yes. Adult men are frequently averaging in the high 90s. Sometimes breaking 100 grams, and women are comfortably averaging around 70 grams.
This is exactly what I mean about the disconnect.
Yeah.
If the average person is already passively clearing 80 to 100 grams a day just by eating standard meals, and many are already naturally hitting that newly elevated 1.2 gram threshold, why are we being aggressively told to add a 25 gram protein shake to our morning commute?
Because the advertising works. Objective nutritional fact checkers have stated plainly that there is no protein famine in America.
Right.
When we look at the nutrients the population is overwhelmingly deficient in, it is dietary fiber, potassium, and vitamin D.
Yeah.
We have a protein marketing surplus, not dietary shortage.
It feels identical to the low-fat craze of the 1990s. Back then, people thought if a box of cookies was fat-free, they could eat the whole box, and it was basically medicine.
Now, we've just swapped the label. We look at a deeply processed candy bar, and if it says 20 grams of protein on the wrapper, we justify it as a health choice.
And that justification stems from a fundamental misunderstanding of how the body handles excess. There is a vast physiological gulf between elite athletic nutrition and everyday human nutrition.
Right.
Sports science does recommend higher ranges, sometimes up to 2.2 grams per kilogram for athletes. But that requirement is specifically for individuals who are aggressively and intentionally tearing down muscle tissue every single day through heavy physical labor.
Because the act of lifting heavy weights or doing resistance work is the actual signal that tells the body it needs to build more muscle.
Exactly. The physical stress is the biological trigger. If you do not send that mechanical signal to the tissue, the body does not simply build new muscle tissue out of boredom.
Right.
Eating a massive steak or drinking an extra protein shake, just in case while you sit on the couch, doesn't spontaneously generate larger biceps. Without the physical demand, extra protein is just extra calories looking for a job. So what exactly happens to all those expensive premium amino acids when they don't have a muscle to repair? Does the body just flush them out?
It's actually a much more labor-intensive process than that. The liver intercepts those excess amino acids. Because amino acids contain nitrogen, which is potentially toxic if it builds up, the liver has to strip the nitrogen off.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. And that nitrogen is converted into urea, which then gets pushed to your kidneys.
Mm-hmm.
The kidneys have to work harder to filter that urea out into your urine.
So you're actually taxing your kidneys just to process the excess you didn't even need.
Correct. And once the liver strips away the nitrogen, it is left with a basic carbon skeleton. The body treats that leftover energy just like any other surplus calorie.
It just stores it.
It converts it into glucose for immediate energy, or it stores it directly as fat. 4 calories per gram is 4 calories per gram. You can absolutely gain adipose body fat by overeating expensive protein powders, just as you can by overindulging in butter or refined carbohydrates.
That is incredibly eye-opening. We are effectively paying a premium price to tax our liver and kidneys only to store the leftovers as fat.
Unfortunately, yes.
This has been a profoundly clarifying deep dive. To bring this all back together, this nutrient is essentially about delivering the correct alphabet of essential building blocks to your DNA's master blueprint.
Yes.
And you can comfortably acquire that entire alphabet from a varied, enjoyable plate of whole foods, whether your diet is entirely plant-based or includes animal products. Our bodies are incredibly adept at sorting it all out. We simply do not have a protein shortage. We have a multi-billion dollar protein sales department.
I think that perfectly synthesizes the biological reality versus the commercial narrative.
So for everyone listening to the Healing Plate podcast today, here is the immediate takeaway for your next grocery run. Let's skip the historical mistake of turning one single isolated nutrient into a dietary religion. You do not need a heavily processed, artificially flavored powder crammed into every snack you eat. Your ribosomes and your cellular machinery are perfectly happy with real, varied food that actually looks like food.
This deep dive does raise one final, incredibly important question, though, and it's something I encourage everyone to reflect on.
What's that?
If the food marketing apparatus has successfully managed to convince an entire nation to obsess over a deficiency in a nutrient that we are already consuming in absolute abundance, what other manufactured nutritional panics are secretly dictating the choices you make in the grocery store aisles right now?
Thank you for listening to the Healing Plate podcast. Eat well and be happy.